some of them do. All right, next case of the morning is number 0860284, Minton versus Commissioner. And we'll hear from Mr. Pesnell or Pesnell?
Pesnell.
Pesnell, okay.
May it please the court, good morning.
Good morning. Morning.
Thank you for your time. This case, the case regarding whether or not certain distributions from a corporation disqualified that corporation for taxation under subchapter S of the Internal Revenue Code. What happened in this case obviously follows a shareholder fight over some ownership issues in state court. With regard to that fight, there was an adjustment, and I think you will find in the record the letter of the CPA from 88 referring to inventory adjustments that needed to be made. Those inventory adjustments were never made, and in 1998, I believe, those adjustments were made because of the conflict. And the question became, is it taxable to the corporation or is it taxable to the shareholders? The corporation issued a K-1 and filed Form 1120-S. Linda Minton filed a notice of inconsistent treatment based on the agreements that she had with her father and her brother.
Well, what had she been doing for the 15 years or so before that?
In what sense?
In other words, it was always passed through before that, right?
Yes, ma'am. And Ms. Minton...
So she suddenly had an epiphany that the corporate structure had changed in 85.
I don't believe she had an epiphany. I believe she came to an understanding from her advisors that they believed that the distributions that were being made in conformance with that agreement constituted a second-class stock. Not been advised that before. The accountant for the corporation, Mr. Dagerpont, had never so advised. The corporation had always issued 1120-S, and the regulations as we understand them required...
I mean, I guess that could be because she never understood... I mean, she never understood it to be such because it wasn't. I mean, she didn't treat it as such.
I don't understand your comment,
well,
sir.
I mean, you said all of a sudden she was advised that this was an issuance of a second stock.
Yes, sir.
Well, I mean, if it were in fact an issuance of a second stock, looks like she is a shareholder in the corporation would know whether it was different stock that had been issued as opposed to that she was receiving.
Judge, I don't think that would be true. They operated this company. She worked for her dad in this company from the time she was 16. And so did her brother, and they came up, and they had stock donated to them over the years. They filed according to what Mr. Dagerpont told them. They didn't know any difference. Quite frankly, if you read the transcripts from the trial testimonies that were in there in Ms. Minton's testimony, and I hope I don't insult her, but quite frankly, none of the parties in this litigation understood much of anything about anything, the underlying litigation.
I want to go to the substance of the transaction. And she knew, at least as... I mean, and she herself testified to that fact, as I understand it. I mean, she knew that money was being paid in her behalf for that stock.
Out of that corporation, yes, sir. But she did not know anything about the effect of that and what the effect would be as a second class of stock with regard to what that corporation's tax filing status ought to be.
Frankly, that's hard for me to credit simply because she filed suit to contest her tax payment, right?
That's correct.
And investing in a lawsuit of this nature is a fairly costly proposition, and I don't think you'd do it unless your advisors were very persuasive and you had the capacity to understand that you were going to have to put out a whole bunch of money to litigate against the IRS here.
Well, I don't think she had a choice, Your Honor, because in the final year when Mr. Long gets caught with the inventory and makes the adjustment, he creates about $180,000 tax liability, assuming it's an S corporation.
And she wanted to dump it on her brother that she was fighting with.
No, ma'am. He got his own tax assessment, and he paid that out of the corporation's funds and after he had cut her off. And, of course, you know, what you have underlying all of this tax issue is some corporate fighting and some minority shareholder abuse. And, you know, Hodge O'Neill could tell you a lot about that if he was still alive. But nonetheless, those assessments arise because the company and its accountant file those tax returns as an 1120-S. She has no choice. My client, quite frankly, doesn't have 180. The size of that adjustment with those tax pops means he had to adjust his inventory in that year by 1.2 million approximately at a 30% or 33% tax rate. So it's a huge adjustment for a small corporation in Alexandria, Louisiana. It's been going on for years. He knew about it. He had told everybody he had fixed it. And then obviously when she doesn't agree to his buyout price, oops, I didn't really fix it. Let me fix it now. It is a classic shareholder abuse tactic, which is to burn out the shareholder by taxation without distributions of earnings, and therefore the taxes can't get paid, the stock gets seized. That's what Mr. Long's been attempting in this case. But nonetheless, it's not that the agreement doesn't exist. Even the trial court found that this agreement existed. Even the trial court found that the payments were being made to service this agreement. And the trial court made, in our opinion, the mistake of saying, but under Regulation 1361-1, you haven't proved to me that that's a binding agreement. Well, I didn't cite him a Louisiana case. I didn't think that agreements that had been made and performed fully, on which the statute of limitations had run, there was any question as to whether or not that agreement was binding or had force and effect. It had already been performed. And secondly, when you get into what the trial court says after that, well, secondly, we didn't make an election. We referred to the regulation. It's the only regulation out there. And the regulation on its face says doesn't apply to agreements prior to 1992. But nonetheless, we think that this claim by Ms. Minton is good under the old law or the new law, either one.
What your argument is, as I understand it, is there's nothing inconsistent about her testimony that the corporation paid for her for 18 shares of the stock of her father, and saying at the same time that it was done in a way that constituted the second class of stock.
That was the agreement of the parties, Judge. The agreement of the parties was, I'm transferring to Mr. Julian W. Long 29 shares. Well, actually, they already had 10, 19 shares in 1986. And I'm transferring to Linda Minton 19 shares in 1986. This transferred effective control of the corporation to the two children. In exchange, he was getting payments from that corporation as he wanted them. He was getting them as state law dividends.
But he's selling the stock. They're not creating new stock. That's why it seems fundamentally inconsistent to me.
No, ma'am, that's because it is a sale either way you go. But in our state, the promise to Port Fort says you can have a three-party transaction.
You can have a what?
Sir?
You can have a what kind of transaction?
It's a French name. I don't know that I say it right because I'm not French, but the promise to Port Fort is what it's called. It's a three-party transaction. And the person who receives the goods, the stock in this case, promises that a third party will discharge the obligation. And that party is not liable for the obligation in our state as long as the third party agrees to discharge and does discharge. At the point the third party agrees to discharge, that person is released from any obligation on the deal.
Well, and the third party, you mean the third party is the corporation?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, but I don't see that because even if what's taking place is, what's taking place is money from the corporation is going to the dad, but it would otherwise have been distributed to Linda and her brother.
No, ma'am. I don't think that's correct, and I'll tell you why. What happens is that corporation pays him, and you can see it in the records, and that started in 92, it's down to $2,000 a month. There was some testimony that
was
higher than that
before.
I
mean,
I understand. But at the end of the day, that corporation, that's how they decided to discharge it. That's how they structured their transaction. They're bound by those tax implications that arise from that. This is the problem that I think the trial court has in the second half of its analysis when it says, well, if this was payment for the purchase of that stock, then really that was monies that should have been allocated to Susie, or her nickname Susie, Linda Minton, or Mr. Long, and therefore it's in discharge of their obligation. You got to find there's an underlying obligation, which there's not in this case because the corporation undertook that duty and they caused that corporation to discharge that duty. The second thing is, if you did that, those distributions would have, if those were in fact distributions that should have been made to them to pay for the stock, number one, Mr. Long Sr. got to pay interest on tax on the interest. He didn't want that. Number two, that money would have been accounted for in those schedules as distributions, additional distributions to Linda Minton and J.W. Minton or J.W. Long. That in itself evidences a disproportionate distribution out of this world because then Mr. J.E. Long has absolutely no distributions except tax payments. It would exacerbate the problem with which shares are perverted.
Well, now, the government argues, and I think the tax judge agreed, that over time the distributions were more or less proportional to their stock interests with one class of stock.
And they're referring to the term that was used by an IRS agent that's been used throughout this litigation by different people, and we probably used it too. The question is, Christy West, the IRS agent, when she came in, and you'll see in exhibit, I think it is 6, Mr. Ken Degpont, that's the son of the accountant of the corporation, indicates to her that, well, these aren't disproportional, grossly disproportional distributions. And the problem with that is that's not the test. If there's an agreement to pay that preferred dividend, that constitutes ipso facto a second class of stock. The idea of disproportionate distributions comes in under 1361 regs and the IRS when they come in and they want to test distributions to try to determine whether or not there's a second class of stock, where there's no stated agreement or otherwise. If they determine that there are substantially disproportionate distributions, then the IRS will come in and declare you have a second class of stock. But they don't have the right under their test to disregard an agreement that's been made and carried out by the shareholders. It's not the same thing. One is an agreement that's been performed and done. The other one is merely a test the IRS uses in aid of its efforts to determine whether or not there is a second class of stock. But just because, and where it comes out to not being grossly disproportional is because this company did have a habit of paying the FICA, the federal and state income taxes of its shareholders, and not just the shareholder and the spouse. So in my case, my client, Linda Minton, is married to Larry Minton, who is an attorney. And if he's anything like me, he has a good year, maybe three bad. But in a good year, those tax payments are higher. If you look, even under the new regulations in 1361, agreements to pay taxes are deemed not to be anything necessarily more than a timing difference.
Well, I think you're getting beyond this case here.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what makes those distributions look somewhat proportional, which I thought is what
you
were asking.
Well, but then they are proportional. I mean, they don't look it, they are.
Well, they can be proportional.
But you're saying that's not probative because the preceding, the question is the stock. But let's go back to that.
The question is the agreement. Is there an agreement to prefer him? The testimony is the transcripts from the trial courts indicate there are. The trial court even found the agreement, found it existed. And then...
Yeah, but the trial court found rather simplistically, but let me just go through with you. I thought these are the critical things.
Okay.
First of all, your client had the burden of proof
as
to what the corporate structure was here. Second, that I didn't think there was proof that the 1986 agreement was binding. Third, there's no corporate record about, you know, what this distribution was, except for the fact that a contemporaneous sale of stock occurred. And finally, I saw it as inconsistent that your client was testifying in the state court that these distributions were made so that she could purchase her dad's share. And I think that's the way the tax court read it, and you have to show that series of conclusions is clearly erroneous, don't you?
I think we have, Judge. I think if you look...
Well,
the burden of, in regard to the burden of proof, the trial court found the agreement existed. The trial court found that he had proof that
agreement
it was final.
Agreement to do what?
To now, pay those preferred payments out of the corporation.
Well, of course. And that's an agreement among shareholders. But how do you, A, bind the corporation? You've got no, and you say, well, it doesn't matter in Louisiana. Well, I find that hard to believe.
No, ma'am, it does matter in Louisiana. It has to be a binding, but a contract performed on which the statute of limitations run, the IRS isn't even entitled to go back and say that those aren't dividends. They're coded as dividends. Statute on those years have run.
Did they pay taxes as dividends?
I'm sure
state
they
taxes?
I'm sure they did, but that goes back to the defense of the IRS, which the trial court judge didn't even rule on. He pretermitted that defense in favor of the holding that he didn't find it was binding. But is it binding? It was clearly binding under Louisiana law. There's no doubt about it. They did it. They performed it. There's a statute that provides for that type of contract directly at issue, and you have the corporate cases that we cited you that show when it's referenced in the corporate records in any way, they're going to enforce those things. Now, the second question you said was about...
get
my bearings, but I think you said that
no corporate formalities.
It's a four shareholder corporation, Judge. Nobody in the state of Louisiana runs those small corporations with the requisite formalities, and quite frankly, they're not required to.
My father-in-law ran a corporation with about 2 shareholders, and they were very careful about their formalities.
Some people
are. And especially because, you know, after my husband went to law school, and her husband went to law school too, so, you know, I just don't.
Some people are very careful, I would agree. Many people run their corporate business without those formalities. They have whole treatises on that. Sub-districts of treatises under the corporation law with Glenn Morris writes. He has a whole subsection on small corporations because they're just not done. Sorry for...
All right, that's okay. You have time for rebuttal. All right, Ms. Hauser.
Good morning, Your Honor. Bethany Hauser for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. I think I'd like to begin by adopting the Chief Judge's assessment of our case in chief, which is that the burden of proof here was on the taxpayer to prove that there was a second class of stock issued, and there's simply a failure of proof here. The only contemporaneous records are the tax returns filed by the corporation from 1986 forward, and all of those show that the corporation continued to be an S corporation.
Yeah, but why objectively can't you look at the transaction and say that a separate class of stock necessarily resulted from the agreement that they had? I mean, because it was clearly a preferential payment to him that they themselves were not receiving, although it had the benefit of compensating him for the stock that he was transferring to them. I mean, why couldn't, I mean, at least in an abstract kind of way, I mean, I can understand how that is not inconsistent with the position that you are urging, that this was simply a purchase of stock in her behalf.
Well, there are two.
It was done through the transaction of a preferential distribution class of stock.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor. There are two comments I'd like to make to that. The first is that the regulation, which does not strictly apply to this, but might reflect how this statute should be interpreted, that regulation provides that in a buy-sell agreement that changes the way the distributions are made because shares are being exchanged between the shareholders themselves, that does not create a second class of stock for purposes of the of this S-corporation rule. And that's in section L2(3).
But everybody agrees that doesn't govern here.
Yes. That is the complication about that. But again, to the extent taxpayers relying on that regulation, the regulation does have an exception for this circumstance.
So then what is your answer to what I'm
then if my
regulation doesn't apply? And the regulation that you were citing and focusing on was...
Well, the law that preceded the regulation was quite stringent on when it would permit an S-corporation to lose its S-corporation status based on the issuance of an additional class of stock, or when it would imply the issuance of another class of stock. Obviously, the formal issuance of another class of stock would always destroy the S-corporation status, but the cases look at equity situations that are quite similar to the issuance of a second class of stock and will not impute a second class of stock to it. And we also cite in our brief certain administrative rulings saying that agreements outside of corporate documents.
What you're in effect saying then is it's the substance of the transaction as opposed to the appearance of the technical.
Yeah, I believe indeed that it's this court in the Amory Oil case said that the substance must control over that the substance must control over the form of the doctrine, or it would effectively read the provision out of the statute. Yes. So I'm afraid I've lost track of.
Well, no.
Have I answered your question?
I mean, I can still see that he was certainly being paid differently from their payment, and it was being paid by the issuance of money from the corporation itself. It was paying him in a different distribution rate than it was paying the others, and that would seem to be a stock that bore a different characteristic from the one that they possessed.
I believe that the corporate records, financial records that are in the record from 1993 forward, show that the distributions are proportionate to the shareholding. Even though the father was receiving these as monthly distributions as opposed to the brother and sister who were receiving them as in larger lump sums at different times, over the course of the year, that doesn't require the IRS to look at that as a different type of stock, because overall they're all receiving distributions proportionate to their shareholdings. And I'd also like to point out that at the tax court trial,
what do you mean overall it was proportionate though? I mean, it was they were paying him proportionately to their interest in the.
I believe they were paying him. He was receiving distributions that were proportionate to his shareholdings, just as their distributions were.
The ownership was something like not quite 40-30-30, but
yes,
something like that, and the payments were proportionate to that 30-30-40 ownership.
The payments to him.
Yes, the payments to the three shareholders.
Among
yes.
the three.
And I'd also just like to point out that in the trial at the tax court, this is at pages 116 to 117 of that transcript, taxpayer testified that in this 1986 agreement, the plan was just to regularize withdrawals that her parents were already making from the corporation, they were just making intermittent withdrawals consistent with their needs, and this was to make it easier for the corporation to plan by having a regular monthly withdrawal. So that would indicate that there was no plan for this agreement to change the underlying structure of the corporate shareholding or what was owed to any shareholder. It was simply to change the timing to make it easier for the corporation to plan.
When you talk about distributions, I don't think I had focused on the idea that the company was paying everybody's tax liabilities.
Yes, that's very common among S corporations.
Okay.
And I believe that the regulation, which again doesn't apply specifically, states that, and opposing counsel referred to this when he was up, that if the distributions are unequal because of different distributions made to cover the tax liabilities, that will not cause the S corporation to lose its status. I don't think that provision would carry quite as far as opposing counsel was arguing it would, but it's certainly part of the regulation.
Okay.
And it's very, very standard for S corporations.
But that's not considered as part of the distributions. That's a separate thing.
Well, it is a distribution from the corporation.
Right, but I mean, that's not in the distributions that you were talking about that are proportional.
Those distributions do include distributions.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right.
Both for federal taxes and for state taxes.
I see.
I'd just like to address the issue of the statute of limitations, which taxpayer raised a little bit in her reply brief, and which also goes to the duty of consistency argument that the commissioner made below. The taxpayer argued in her reply brief that any inquiry into this 1986 agreement was barred by the statute of limitations. I think that's clearly wrong. If the statute of limitations operated as a bar here, it would prevent the taxpayer from recharacterizing this agreement, because after all, she did file over a decade of tax returns, where she continued to treat the corporation as an S corporation. But actually, the statute of limitations bars recomputation of her tax liability for those years, but doesn't prevent us from looking at what the agreement meant in that year, unless it's inside of some larger doctrine, such as the duty of consistency, which also looks at other considerations and not merely the statute of limitations.
But that's not, duty of consistency isn't before us.
No, the duty of consistency would require a remand.
Okay, any other questions?
I'd like to ask the court to affirm the tax court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right. Mr. Pesnell.
I would like to address that statute of limitations argument myself. The statute of limitations bars them going back to reconfigure those transactions in those prior years. Ms. Minton's position doesn't require anybody to reconfigure any transaction. In fact, we rely on those transactions from those years. Those were absolute payments of preferred equity. And even in the statutes, the Law Review case cited by the government from Blau and Lemons, it's clear that intended distinctions in financial rights, i.e. preferences payments,
What I don't understand, so basically, to me, it is just fundamentally inconsistent to say, yes, we were buying our daddy's stock, but no, what we're paying him with is a separate class of stock.
I don't see anything fundamentally inconsistent
because
with that at all.
Because getting is a quid pro quo.
Well, and here's Mr. Long's quid pro quo. He's got a company he built, and he knows it's operating, is making a certain amount of money, and he knows he can get that money out of there. If it's a personal obligation of Linda Minton or Larry Minton might have a heart attack. They may not have enough money to pay him. It is exactly consistent with them buying that stock and that transfer and creating that second class to make sure he gets dividend treatment so that he doesn't have to pay interest or taxation on the interest and doesn't have to file those on the notes. And quite frankly, Mr. Dagupont advised him that taking these distributions was a quote-unquote distribution other than a dividend, which was his favorite term. You'll see it in his testimony that he uses with regard to S-corporations because an S-corporation is not taxed under Section 301. That's what Mr. Dagupont would call it. And Mr. Dagupont called it that and called it that until I looked at him and said, that's just for tax purposes, right? Still a state law dividend. And yeah, right. So, you know, it makes perfect sense that he could transfer that and request that this corporation, they're in control of the corporation now, they can cause that corporation to make those payments to him.
But they did. But that's what I'm saying, though.
If they're
paying for the stock. He didn't gift it to them, right? If he had gifted it to them, they might have had some tax consequences.
They had gifting before that, and with 10 shares each as of 96 were gifted to them. And with regard to the statement that, it was to even out his distributions, it certainly was.
But they testified it was a sale of the stock.
Yes, ma'am, it would be a sale for tax purposes either way you go.
Well, she's not smart enough to know that, is she? Because she was treating the whole thing as subchapter S for all this time.
Well, she didn't have to report it. She was the person that acquired the stock. What should have happened probably was there probably was some income effect that should have been adjusted and realized in that year with regard to the stock valuation. But nonetheless, substance over form doesn't give the IRS the right to disregard the transactions recognized by the state of Louisiana. And our state clearly says you can have a transaction where I sell you A, and in exchange for that, you, the person who acquires A, promises a third party will discharge some obligation.
Is that a principle of corporate law or a principle?
That's a principle of basic obligations.
And
in this case, the people in control of the corporation cause that corporation to discharge that obligation.
Except for that corporate law doesn't normally work like that.
Yes, well,
you just don't have handshakes in corporate law.
You do in small corporations, Judge.
Well,
I mean, with all due respect, you do in small corporations. Most of those people don't keep any minutes. If you'll look in the minutes that were entered by the government.
I'm making a different point.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You've been over that one. No, but what I'm saying is that the idea that a corporation can be called upon to discharge some obligation on sort of what's a handshake of the shareholders could be a rather troubling thing. That could open the door to multiple, piercing the corporate veil and that sort of thing. Now, surely your clients wouldn't want to risk that, would they? I mean, in other words,
I think my client would love to pierce the corporate veil and go after Julian W. Long right now. But in response to your question, though, I think the question is, if they bought it, how's the company paying for it? Why are we doing that? If you look at these corporate records in Exhibit 6 in particular, especially when you get to the later years in 96 when Daddy finally sold the last of his shares, they understand, Mr. Dagupont understood how to code those transactions. He understood if that corporation paid money out and it was a loan, that he was going to credit debit a receivable and credit the cash. He understood that when he put it out and it was a dividend, it went to the distribution account. And if you take those tax payments, because Mr. J.E. Long Jr. was getting the tax payments too. And if you look at those schedules, every month that Ms. Minton or Mr. Long got a tax payment, the senior got a tax payment. And you take those out, and all you got is $2,000 a month left to him.
All right, sir. Thank you
for your time.
Thank you.